come to order this morning, and we have three bills. What I'm going to do is consolidate the public hearing and possible work sessions on House Bills 2415 and 2016 at this time, and ask the following people to come forward. I think I have nobody testifying in opposition. Representative Hass, please, will go first. Followed by Jacqueline Zimmer and Rick Bennett and Timothy Marble. Good morning.
Well, thank you, Chair Ackerman. And
let me have the council explain the bills for us first, Representative.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2415 establishes rules governing the passage of property from an individual who suffers physical or financial abuse. Currently under the statutory scheme, a slayer or somebody who kills another person is basically not allowed to benefit from that person's death. House Bill 2415 would add an abuser to the people who are not allowed to benefit under that person's death. An abuser is somebody who financially or physically abuses another person, and that person dies within 5 years of that abuse.
Okay, for just the purpose of the record, I'm going to open a consolidated public hearing on House Bills 2415 and 2416. And Representative, please identify yourself.
Thank you, Chair. Mark Hass, House District 27. Chair Ackerman, I've asked Timothy Marble to help me with this. He's actually an elder abuse attorney who helped draft this bill with legislative counsel. As you heard, this does amend the Slayer Law, the law dating back to 1917, which essentially tried to prevent people from shooting each other so that they couldn't collect from the victim's will. This change, which was suggested by elder abuse agencies and by attorneys who specialize in elder abuse law, would prohibit people convicted of abusing someone from later benefiting from the will when that person dies. You'll hear about a very notorious case in my district in Washington County where a woman essentially befriended and then stole hundreds of thousands of dollars from a senior. She was actually convicted of felony financial abuse and sentenced to prison. Even with that, however, she still stands to inherit from this man's will when he dies, because he named her in his will, and this is the proposal that aims to cut that out, because we're seeing this kind of a thing on an increase. According to the National Center on Elder Abuse, in just 2000, there were more than 516 cases of seniors and people with disabilities who reported financial abuse in Oregon. 12% of Oregon's reported cases of abuse against seniors and with persons with disabilities involve financial abuse. So sadly, this abuse is on the rise, and as Oregon's population increases and ages, these crimes are almost certain to increase.
Thank you.
I'll turn it over to Mr. Marble.
Yes, I prefer both of you testify before we entertain questions.
Okay.
May.
Thank you. My name is Timothy Marble. I am a practitioner in Western Washington County. I have a small office in Forest Grove. As a matter of clarification first, I've handed out some a written testimony with some attachments. At the top, it states that this is in support of House Bill 2416. This is in support of 2415, and I apologize for any confusion. I first became involved in elder abuse issues a number of years ago, not in small part because my family is from Washington County and has lived there for over 50 years, and they are aging, and their friends are aging, and so my clients naturally were the older population. I became disturbed about a case, and I complained to the local Department of Aging why more was not being done in order to prevent abuse, financial abuse in particular, although physical abuse is on the rise. And as a result, they put me on a task force, which has been good and bad because the time commitment, obviously, it takes a lot of time to be on to do volunteer work, but the rewards are great. One of the rewards is the case that I've attached to my testimony here. It's the case of Roxanna Thomas. Roxanna Thomas was a grocery store clerk at Lamb's Thriftway in Garden, in Garden Home in the Beaverton area. She befriended an elderly gentleman who came in to drink coffee with his buddies. He was a World War II veteran. He had some cognitive disabilities, but it's not something that's obvious. He came in, he drank coffee with his buddies. He was a stable at the store, would get donuts. And Ms. Thomas befriended him, and within a short matter of time, she offered to help him with his finances, help him with his Medicare planning. And before long, she was in his pocket. He had made gifts to her in excess of $180,000 outright. She was a joint owner in all of his accounts. She stood to inherit more than $600,000. We did an emergency guardianship and conservatorship, and fortunately we were able to recover most of the money before it had been spent. To make a long story short, we were tied up in a civil proceeding for a long period of time. One of the problems with the case is that he did not one, but actually two different wills. I've attached the latest will that he did as the last exhibit to my testimony here. In the will, it's pretty clear he had virtually no relatives. The only relative he had in the area was a stepdaughter from his third marriage. And what he did was there's this pattern, a very obvious pattern of Roxanne Thomas persuading him to turn over more and more control of his assets to her. In the first will, the stepdaughter was named, and in the second will, she was cut out altogether. I did a deposition with the victim, and in the deposition, I asked him to write down the number 50,000 because that's how much he gave to the perpetrator's son to go to PCC for college. He wrote the number 50,000 down. 2 minutes later, I asked him to tell me how much the number was that he just wrote down. He said, well, that's 5,000. I asked him three times. He said, that's 5,000. He clearly did not have the mental capability to understand what he was doing. Unfortunately, the way the law is, he has a will that is a valid will. We were able to get to negotiate a settlement with Ms. Thomas in order to get her prospectively to waive her right to an inheritance, so we fixed the problem to a certain degree, but the will is still a valid will, and she could challenge it on his death. I see more and more of these cases all the time. It is very important. I drafted this legislation not only out of this case, but out of many other cases that have come to light. And I highly advocate for the passage of this bill. Thank you.
Fine, thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Garag?
Mr. Chair, can we ask questions in regards to 16 as well as 15?
Yes, it's a consolidated public hearing.
I'm just a little bit concerned about in 16, where it describes the senior as emotionally disturbed. That could be temporary, that could be a lot of different things, but under your bill, that could qualify that individual. Can you relax my concerns there a little bit?
I'd like to defer to Representative Haas on that one.
You're on 224.16. We don't have copies of those up here.
Representative, could you cite the paragraph or the line or page number? So we're on the same page.
I'm talking about the in the SMS is where it describes it, and I have
what section, Representative Ferrard?
Well, unfortunately, I got that off of our SMS.
What?
On 2416, under background, item number 4, it says persons with disabilities, so I suspect that's where I need to be.
Section 1.
Section 1?
Subsection 1D.
Yeah, okay. Section 1, line 10, sub D, person with disabilities has the meaning given that term in ORS 124, and then apparently ORS 124 says individuals who are mentally retarded, developmentally disabled, emotionally disturbed, and that's kind of the definition. That's so loose that it might also leave some room for some abuse somewhere.
Thank you for that. I do know that there has been discussion about which definition of disabled population to use on this bill. Before I go to that, let me just back up real quickly as to why what this bill is about. You all, I think, on this committee voted for the triple damages bill for seniors in the last session that effectively gave seniors the ability to sue for three times the amount if they were victims of financial abuse. That bill passed the House. Then when it was in the Senate and had passed the Senate Judiciary Committee and was on its way to the Senate floor, the Senate Judiciary Committee had closed down, and some representatives from the disabled population had asked if we could get disabled persons amended into that bill, but it was too late. And the reasoning was, well, we'll put this in next session if the bill works, if the new law works out. And I'm happy to report that in this first year that it's been in effect, that it, lawyers on these issues say that it has worked extremely well. As much as anything, it's a deterrent, and they've had successful phone calls trying to unwind shady insurance deals and annuity contracts that were sold to seniors. So it has worked well, and we're just back this time adding this layer of protection for the disabled population in this state. If there is a better definition in Oregon law that would be a better match, then maybe we could have a friendly amendment to change that. But right now I'm uncertain as to, you know, which is the best definition of a disability, person with disabilities. So
follow, Mr. Ulate. We've been, the past several weeks, this committee's been educated in regards to passing bills that somewhere down the line a court will have to interpret our intent. That's my concern here, is that just simply saying an emotionally disturbed senior would leave a door wide open for interpretation. And again, is it a temporary thing, or is it what is the definition of emotionally disturbed? That concerns me, and I think we're leaving a lot of room there for interpretation.
Can I answer that?
Council.
Representative Garrard, I have a couple points on that question. First, it's my understanding that a person with disabilities does not have to be a senior. That's elderly persons in the first section. A person with disabilities is not a senior. I heard you mention that, so I just wanted to clarify that.
Well, that's what the bill is about, seniors. But go ahead.
Yeah. The second point I wanted to make, under that definition, if you look at ORS 124.005, for that specific definition, it's a person who is not only emotionally disturbed, but also is residing in a program administered by the DHS or waiting to be placed in a residential program administered by the DHS under that one specific definition.
I do.
So both those elements have to be met. The person has to be emotionally disturbed and either living or waiting to live in a residential facility administered by the DHS. Under the next sentence, it's also individuals who have other physical or mental disabilities. So I don't know if just purely being emotionally disturbed is sufficient to be a person with disabilities. Is that making sense? Or
yeah, in a way, it helps define what emotionally disturbed is. So,
okay.
Counsel, are you suggesting that there's qualifications on in the statute on the definition of emotionally disturbed?
For the particular definition that Representative Garrard is pointing out, and if I had to, I don't know if, do you have the
I have ORS Chapter 410, which is cross-referenced in 124.005, which is the where the term is referenced over in this bill. So you have to kind of get a couple of steps over. I probably have the volumes you'd be looking for right here.
All I'm saying, Chair Ackerman, is that if it is a person with that is emotionally disturbed, they also have to be either living in or waiting to be placed in a residential program that's administered by the DHS. That's the language in ORS 124.005. I think there's three criteria or three ways that somebody can qualify as being a person with disability. And under that specific subsection, I think it's subsection A, if a person is emotionally disturbed, they also have to be living or waiting to be placed in a residential program administered by DHS.
Let me ask Representative Girard if those are qualifications meet your objection to provide greater understanding of statutory intent.
I think I'd like to be assured by perhaps Representative Haas that he's okay with it. If you're okay with this thing, Representative, then I'll drop my objection.
Representative Girard, I'm okay with it. You know, the real intent here is to wrap another layer of protection around vulnerable people.
And I understand that, Mr. Chair, and my concern was just interpretation.
Yeah.
To avoid a conflict somewhere in a court proceeding. So,
other questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative McPherson.
I think Representative Girard raises a good area of focus here, because the one of sort of the modern trends in the law is to treat an expanding range of conditions as constituting disabilities, and some of the things that are identified in unrelated statutes, particularly under federal laws, being disabilities, I think are things that we would not regard as appropriate to trigger the protections that are involved here. Now, if I'm reading the cross-references here right, and I realize counsel was at a disadvantage because I had taken away the relevant ORS volumes, but the key definition looks like to me is a disabled person is a person who's eligible for supplemental security income, that's Social Security's SSI program, and meets one of the following criteria, and there are three subdivisions under that. A is mentally retarded, developmentally disabled, or mentally or emotionally disturbed, and resides in or needs placement in a residential program and administered by the department. So I think that goes to the kind of disability that we're concerned about. I see that there's a couple of alternatives, though. B is an alcohol or drug abuser and resides in or needs placement in a residential program administered by the department. That may be less appropriate. Or the third, has a physical or mental disability other than those described in subparagraphs A and B of this paragraph. And I guess it would be that cap C that would be my concern, is physical or mental disability. The person who has a physical disability wouldn't necessarily be impaired in their ability to look after their own financial affairs. So if I'm following this right, there may be one avenue that maybe opens this a little broader than what we would intend.
Well, thank you. I think perhaps the vice that we're seeing here is when legislative counsel incorporates other statutes by reference, and they have other qualifications that may not meet our needs. I think that's perhaps where.
Yeah, and as I say, this is just based on a two or three minute read of this, and I would defer to people who've studied it more closely than I.
Representative Ackerman, you're right. Jacqueline Zimmer has joined us, and she's flagged this for the very exact reasons that there is a better definition, perhaps, of people with disabilities that would not have any unintended consequences and would better target this population.
Mr. Chair, if I could, Jacqueline Zimmer,
the
Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. And I think, as it's been pointed out to me, that the definition of disability in this bill is actually tied to the definition that's used to determine financial eligibility for services within the state system. So we do have an alternative definition of disability, that language that we've just given to Mark, and I apologize for giving it to him at the last moment. It was actually just handed to me. So I think you're right. There's some there's some confusion, and I think that's where it originates from. It's from tying it to the financial eligibility piece. So,
do you want to read what it would be?
The information that's been given to me came from seniors and people with disabilities. So they're saying that the problem, ORS 410-040, defines disabled person as a person with a mental or physical disability who is eligible for supplemental security income or for general assistance. So there's the connection to financial eligibility right there. Adult Protective Services isn't meant to be tied to financial eligibility, but really to vulnerability. So they're suggesting that you refer to an existing statutory site for the definition of disabled person, and it's ORS 174.107, and it defines it as any person who has a physical or mental impairment which substantially limits one or more major life activities, has a record of such an impairment, or is regarded as having such an impairment. And then it goes from there.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Pearson.
Ms. Zimmer, though, you referred to a mental or physical impairment. I guess the concern I have is that if we pick up physical impairments, people who are very sharp mentally and can manage their financial affairs may be picked up in this because they have a physical limitation. Am I hearing the language correctly?
Has a physical or mental impairment which substantially limits one or more major life activities. I'm not really certain, and you may want to ask Morgan Brody to quantify that. If she's with seniors and people with disabilities, let me just hand that to her.
Chair Ackerman, Representative McPherson, thank you for allowing us to speak to this. One of the issues that we see, unfortunately, all too often, as Mr. Marvel has referred to, when people have physical disabilities, often they're reliant upon a caregiver or a family member to do their financial transactions for them. And so we have heard a number of stories from people who have trusted their caregivers to go to the bank to get their ATM cards because the person, him or herself, does not have access to be able to do those functions. The caregivers then intercept the mail, intercept the bank statements, and the victim doesn't often know until they are sometimes in a bankruptcy position that they have been financially exploited. So even though the mental capacity is there in some of those people, the lack of physical ability sometimes seriously impinges on their ability to defend themselves financially.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Wouldn't we be able to respond to that concern if the definition referenced impairing their ability to deal with the financial activities of their life, but if they were fully able to deal with financial issues but couldn't walk or under the federal law, I think that parallel language about unable to engage in certain life activities has been interpreted quite broadly under the Americans with Disabilities Act, and to the point where we'd be spreading this around maybe to people that we wouldn't ordinarily think of as being vulnerable.
Chair Ackerman, Representative McPherson, again, in terms of our administrative rule for interpreting eligibility for Adult Protective Services, we're looking at people whose disability of whatever type makes them vulnerable to exploitation and various kinds of abuse or neglect. And again, for many of the people that we work with, the intellectual acuity is there to deal with financial matters, but simply because they cannot access their bank or, in some cases, their computer or do the banking or financial transactions, go to the store themselves, they're reliant on a person to do that who is exploiting them. So to limit the definition in this case to the intellectual ability or inability to handle financial transactions, I'm afraid, would not extend this right to civil action to people who are exploited simply because of physical disabilities.
Representative, if I may, I strongly agree with that just because someone mentally is capable doesn't mean they are not vulnerable for those reasons. And if someone is dependent upon another person to take them to the bank or any other way, then they become vulnerable, and I think they deserve this layer of protection. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You may.
No, I'm fine.
Oh, you're fine. Further questions from the committee? Let me think that I'm just trying to see what we need to do, and since the consensus of the committee, I think would I be fair in stating, committee, that we are in doubt about the definition of qualified person here, and that they should come back in a form of amendment?
I'd like to see that, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I'm having problems.
I sense that's a consensus of the committee. Okay. And I think I want to just make one more pitch for not relying so much on tying into other statutory references unless you further qualify them. The point that Representative McPherson made about the definitional language of being disabled or having been regarded as disabled is, as he rightfully says, is a test on the American with Disabilities Act and the state counterpart. It's extremely subjective and extremely open to a large variety of interpretations. So I think our consensus is that definition is canceled too widely here, and if you folks want to come back with appropriate amendments, maybe check with me ahead of time or check with Representative McPherson, we can tailor this to get it through. So is there any more anyone else here that would like to participate in the public hearing in House Bill 2416? Yes, I have someone from the back. You want to come forward, please identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Davis. Representing the Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities, the Oregon Association for Retired Citizens, United Seniors of Oregon, and the Gray Panthers. I'm here and I'm gathering I can just lump both bills together. They sir, is 2415 and 2416, can I speak to both of those? Are we talking about both those bills now, or are we just talking about the one?
I'm sorry, I was distracted. Yes, we're consolidating both hearings. I haven't closed the hearings yet.
Oh, so can I speak to both bills then?
Yeah, please.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. we are here to express our support for both 2416 and 2415. As you have already heard, in 2415, it essentially keeps family members and friends from gaining inheritance when they have been abusing or taking advantage of a senior and incapacitated individual. We really feel very strongly that adds protections for vulnerable individuals that helps keep them safe, much safer from the results of financial gain from an abuser. It is good protection that helps address and combat serious problems of financial exploitation of seniors who often have serious physical and emotional disabilities. In the case of 2416, again, that expands the legislation to include a wider definition of vulnerable persons, and I must confess that I am the guilty party that last session came to Representative Haas and asked that I had been working with him on this piece of legislation last session through the Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities. We had asked that people with disabilities be included, amended into this legislation, as the representative stated. It was a little late in the ball game at that point, and it was better for us to wait and come at that difficulty this session. The concern that we had at the time is that the bill was only addressing one aspect of our system. Our system deals with both seniors and people with serious disabilities, adults with serious disabilities. Both of these populations were being taken advantage of and being abused and financially exploited, and we wanted to make sure that was addressed in this legislation that allowed for penalties, much greater penalties, for those individuals that were taking advantage of them. And so we saw the fact that that fraud and abuse was increasing in both populations and wanted to make sure that both populations were included in this statute because both were being affected and both were part of our system. And we're experiencing, you know, increased crime against them, greater financial losses. Many individuals are losing thousands and thousands of dollars because of this type of abuse. And oftentimes, people were in no position to replace the money. They were barely surviving oftentimes as it was. And so we would very much appreciate coming to an understanding around the definition of people with disabilities and being able to move forward with this legislation because it is very, very important that they be included in it as well. And most of the people you're talking about, people with disabilities, are people with serious physical or mental health disabilities that can easily be taken advantage of. And they truly do deserve to be part of the language of this statute. And as both the senior and disability populations are growing by leaps and bounds, we're only seeing these fraud problems worsening, and they're creating much greater hardship on vulnerable individuals. So there really needs to be stronger penalties in place to protect vulnerable populations and to ensure that there are greater penalties for those that are abusing these victims. So we ask you to support both 2415 and 2416. They're both good bills.
Thank you. Any questions of the witness from the committee? Any further persons wishing to testify on House Bill 2415 and 2416? Good morning again. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning again, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jacqueline Zimmer with O4AD, and I appreciate the time you're taking to look at the bill that we were just referring to. We're charting new territories here by including people with disabilities, and so we'd be happy to work with you on some new language around that, and appreciate Representative Haas's actions on this particular bill. We did want to include people with disabilities last session, and they're really... was in time, and he did honor his commitment to include them this session, so we appreciate his work. One of the things I just want to point out to you is that with the cuts that seniors and people with disabilities have endured over the last 4 or 5 years as a result of the state's budget, there are more people out there who are subject to self-neglect, but are also just basically more, they're sort of better targets for neglect and fraud and abuse and mishandling by people around them, oftentimes family members. So we support both of these bills, and we appreciate you taking a look at them.
Thank you. Questions of the committee? Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Good morning. For the record, Rick Bennett, Associate State Director, AARP, Oregon. We support both of these bills, but I want to speak specifically to 2415. Elder abuse occurs without reference to race, religion, income, education, place of residence, or living arrangement. Because abuse is not always reported, information as to who is likely to suffer a particular type of abuse is unavailable. It is known that physical abuse is more likely to involve a spouse, adult child, or other family member rather than a non-relative. At the same time, we see a significant increase in cases of financial abuse. With that in mind, as I said, AARP Oregon supports both these legislations, and specifically 2415. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions of the witness by the committee? Thank you very much. Any other members wishing to participate in the public hearing on these two bills? If not, I'll close the public hearing on House Bills 2415 and 2416. Move to work session on House Bill 2415. Need a motion?
Mr. Chair. Mr.
President
Chair.
Gerard.
I would move House Bill 2415 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Discussion? There is no discussion. The Chair will call for the vote on House Bill 2415.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Worth excused. Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 2415 has received a majority vote of the subcommittee, and the bill will be forwarded to the full committee with the due pass recommendation. Thank you for your participation. We'll anxiously await the proposed amendments on House Bill 2416 before we proceed further on that bill. Thank you very much.
Who's the carrier? 2415 is going to carry it to the...
I'll carry 2415. I will proceed to a public hearing on House Bill 2373. We have Representative Burley, Senator Morris, and Senator Beyer. Please come forward. And also Senator Westland. Gentlemen, however you wish to proceed. And while, before we start, let me just make a couple of introductory remarks. So first, let me have counsel explain the bill, and then I have a couple of remarks. We can proceed.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2373 eliminates the civil liability of sellers and manufacturers of firearms or ammunition for damages resulting from the unlawful use of firearms. It also sets out specific exceptions to the limitation of civil liability for things such as negligent entrustment, product liability, breach of contract, breach of warranty, and certain other statutory violations.
Thank you. My comments are these. We received a note from staff counsel and from legislative counsel regarding the possible unconstitutionality of this bill. I don't believe that this is the venue or the domain to talk about, to really talk extensively about that unless there are some remarks that are necessary. I prefer to proceed on the merits of the bill and submit the bill, if it's on its merits, to the full committee and maybe have this discussion at that point. But it's not my intention at this level to raise a constitutional issue as a means to thwart the passage of the bill to the full committee. So I want you to know that.
Okay.
Please identify yourselves and let me know how you want to proceed.
Why don't I go ahead and start? Mr. Chairman, I'm Representative Chuck Burley, and I appreciate you having the hearing on 2373, a measure that I have sponsored. Also, for the record, you should have a letter dated February 7, 2005 from Nosler Incorporated. This company, Nosler, is a privately owned small business located in my district. They've been in the business of manufacturing ammunition for three generations, and they have just recently started manufacturing firearms. Nosler is known the world over for its quality, and they produce products for the general public as well as law enforcement and military applications. I believe it's important that you consider this bill as a right to manufacture legislation. At its heart is the premise that a manufacturer or seller of firearms or ammunition should not become the target of civil litigation as a result of the illegal use of these products. The bill has been crafted to include specific language that preserves a plaintiff's right to seek damages in cases involving warranty or product liability. From the sale of Oregon hunting licenses to the taxes paid by the Oregon's firearms-related businesses and their employees, the manufacture and sale of firearms, ammunition, and accessories are an important part of commerce. Companies such as Leupold and Stevens, which is located in Beaverton and employs several hundred employees, Michaels of Oregon, Crimson Trace, Oregon Trail Bullet Company, these are all well-known manufacturers in Oregon producing a wide variety of quality accessories for the firearms and shooting sports industry. In addition, on the retail side, there are several large dealers, Walmart, Bi-Mart, G.I. Joe's, Sportsman's Warehouse, that also all employ several hundreds of people in Oregon. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I believe this right to manufacture concept should apply to all legitimate businesses and industries, but the firearms industry is often discriminated against because of the illegal use of firearms, and it is for this reason that we must take action to protect this legitimate industry from the frivolous lawsuits aimed to run it out of business. So in closing, Mr. Chairman, there are many citizens in Oregon that participate in shooting sports. We have a segment of commerce that works well, and protecting it is a worthwhile endeavor. I respectfully urge you to support this measure, and thank you again for this hearing.
Thank you, Representative. And I think we'll take the testimony of the rest of the panel before we open it for questions. So whichever senator wishes to proceed first, let me know. Senator Westland, by default.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ben Westland, District 27, Central Oregon. In essence, this is a very simple but fundamental bill, and its sole intent is to preclude the frivolous and unnecessary litigation over legally manufactured and, keyword, sold products, in this case, firearms and firearms accessories. Historically, these actions have occurred from an injured party in the illegal use of a product, in this case, a firearm. It is easily and as logical to assume that baseball bat manufacturers could be held liable for the illegal assault with a baseball bat against another human being, just as it would be for someone who is injured by a firearm in an illegal act. It is quite simply, as my good colleague and friend Representative Burley has said, a right and protection to manufacture bill. That's the intent of this legislation. We hope you will give it your due consideration, and we will certainly get to the bottom at a later date of any of the constitutional issues that may be surrounding this legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Colleagues, for the record, Frank Morris, State Senator, representing the Albany and Corvallis areas of our state. I'd like to focus my comments on in two broad areas. One, from my own personal experience from the economics side of this issue, and then also from a personal experience. And I think that will maybe raise an issue that we don't often think about. From the economic side, I chair the board and I am also an investor in a small company in Sweet Home. It's a relatively new company. It's about 3 or 4 years old. And we manufacture Heavy Shot, which is a trade name for a non-toxic, heavier-than-lead birdshot. And we are co-branding that with Remington Arms throughout North America. We're also selling and distributing throughout the United Kingdom and Europe with this product. It's a company that's growing and meeting some interesting demands in the marketplace for a product that's more dense than lead and is non-toxic. With respect to the liability aspect of product liability, I would just share with you that for $6 million in revenue, the premium that would be paid, if you can get it, number one, the traditional markets are not available. You cannot get product liability in the firearms industry for ammunition, at least in our experience. And if you could get it, the range of premium cost is in the $250,000 per year premium for a $1 million basic policy and a $5 million umbrella. Now, there's one company in the United States that specializes in insuring the firearms industry, and that's a company out of New England. And we're able to get a premium for $165,000 annual premium for a $1 million basic and a $5 million umbrella. So what you're seeing is from the economic side, in response to the litigation that has been brought against these companies that manufacture, a very restricted market in supplying insurance. I'd like to share with you another side of this issue that does not often surface. I'd like to share with you an experience, my own personal experience in the shooting sports and in hunting. When I was 5 years old, I recall my father coming home. He was hurried. He packed his bags. He had his rifle, a 30-30 carbine in one hand, his bags in the other, and he was kissing my mother goodbye to head out on a hunting trip with his brothers, and it's a traditional event. And I remember this so distinctly, being 5 years old, standing next to my mother, and my father looked down at me, and I started to cry. And he said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "Daddy, I'd like to go with you." 5 years old. And he looked down at me and he said, "Son, let's get your stuff together. You can go." And from that moment on, I was able to go with Dad hunting every year. And it was a tradition in our family that involved my aunts, my uncles, my grandparents, it was just a tremendous family event. I started out carrying a BB gun. Then I started carrying a .22 without shells in the chamber. And I was able to put it in the chamber. And when I was 10 years old, I was able to, fortunately, I killed my first deer hunting. But what I'm trying to explain to you is that the shooting sports provide opportunities for young people today to bond with their family and enjoy this beautiful outdoors that we have here in the West in a way that is truly extraordinary. And when I reflect on that experience, what I see is truly character development, because you learn responsibility at a very early age. Safety, gun safety, was absolutely paramount in all respects. But then when you emerge from that walking behind your father with an empty rifle to you're out there on your first hunt all by yourself, the sense of responsibility to make those decisions, to make them appropriately, and that sense of independence. And those are learning experiences. And what I would suggest to you is that the industry is under such attack today that we are potentially jeopardizing those kinds of experiences for our young men and women throughout America. And it's unfortunate. The shooting sports industry is a great industry. And we often hear the negative side of the criminal acts that are committed with firearms, but we very seldom focus on the positive aspects of this industry, and they are tremendous. And I would ask for your consideration for this bill. It's a good bill, and one that will help preserve an industry here in Oregon that, while it's small, it is significant. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Questions from the committee? Representative Girard.
My morning. Representative Burley or Senator Westland, I received an email from a Michael Getty in Lakeview, Oregon, that I think raises an interesting question that I would like to have your opinion on, in reference to Section 1, Paragraph 2A, the phrase, "or should have known." This is used in the proper context, a civil action against a seller by reason of use of a firearm by a purchaser to whom the seller sold the firearm, if the seller knew or should have known that the purchaser was likely to use the firearm in a manner that would cause unreasonable risk. Could you tell me why "or should have known" is in there?
Senator Westland. For the record, Senator Westland. Good question, fair question, Representative Girard, and that is the statutory standard that's centered around the legislation that was, actually was an initiative that was passed closing the loophole in the gun show laws for the sellers having to be licensed and do the background check. That is the standard that was established through the initiative process now statutorily. So that is common language, if you will. I do agree with what I think your line of questioning is, you know, how are some of these sellers to know that there was criminal intent in the heart of a otherwise normal legal buyer, and that is the letter of the law, is that if he is a legal buyer and he passes the background check, that is the protection for the seller.
Further questions of the panel? Representative McPherson.
First, let me start by saying that I appreciated particularly Senator Morse's remarks because it reminded me of coming-of-age experiences of my own growing up on a farm in Linn County and the excitement that the first day of hunting season brought each year. And those were really treasured kinds of memories. I want to focus on what the scope of this ought to be, again, setting aside the constitutional issue. It might seem to some as though this is sort of a theoretical kind of issue, but we did in some research find that there is one appellate court case in Oregon involving a fact pattern in which would be affected by this bill. It was one of a prominent big box retailer about 25 years ago here in Oregon from whose store after hours there was a break-in and a firearm that was being displayed along with the ammunition without any kind of security system was then taken by somebody and used to commit a homicide, and a lawsuit was brought against that that store, and it was thrown out at the circuit court level, but then went up to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals held that there could be a cause of action based on negligence in the store's display of the firearm, and now that case was subsequently that the holding in it was overturned by a subsequent case on unrelated facts. But what I wanted to get a reaction from the panel is there any level of inattention to the sort of proper standards of storage by, say, a retail outlet or a manufacturing outlet that would be something that ought to be preserved and give rise to a cause of action? Or is it the intent of this bill to essentially create a cause of action or to eliminate any cause of action at all where there's an illegal act? In that case, it was a break-in to a store, so clearly an illegal act in taking the weapon away. And I would open that up to anybody in the panel who wants to respond.
Could you reduce that question to fewer words?
Certainly, Senator. Is it the intent of this bill to eliminate any liability that could arise no matter what level of care was taken by either a manufacturer or a retailer in the safeguarding of the weapons and the storage of them along with ammunition?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, I think that the second exception addresses that as far as state and federal statutes governing the sale and marketing of the product. I think between that and the third one, the licensing requirement under 18 U.S. Code 923, those types of safeguards should be in place.
I'm sorry, Representative. It's is it 2B that you're referring to?
2B refers to the marketing, sale or marketing of the product, yes. Stater says a civil action against a manufacturer or seller of a firearm or ammunition based on a willful violation of a state or federal statute governing the sale or marketing.
Right. The key phrase there, I think, is willful violation. So clearly that anything that's willful by the retailer would be carved out of the protection provided by the Act. But the fact pattern in this, it happens to be the Kimbler v. Stilwell is the case from 1980 from the Oregon Court of Appeals. Or actually, I guess, 1987. And that case involved negligence in the way that the firearms were being displayed and stored within the retail outlet.
Any further questions of the panel? Senator Wessling, you have a comment?
Well, Senator Wessling, just in response to Representative McPherson's question, I think this bill would still leave open liability to a seller or indeed a manufacturer if they were negligent in the storage, display, security, or protections of the firearm while they were under their custody or control prior to a sale. I mean, if you left your back door open with lights saying, you know, come rob us, no, that seller or manufacturer would still be liable under the negligence laws. What I think this bill specifically addresses goes more to the root of the legal manufacturer, legal sale with customary standard precautions as well as abiding by state statutes regarding the proper identification of a lawful buyer. So I still think there would be negligence under, you know, allowable under, or a negligence claim could still be made if there was improper care and custody of those firearms while in the while they were still in the control of either the manufacturer or the seller.
Let me make a comment just to continue the discussion. To my ear, the language in, that we're looking at here, knew or should have known, is essentially a negligence standard by my training and experience. My criticism of 2A is that the remedy would only come about if the seller knew or should have known that the purchaser was likely to use the firearm. My question to you, is there a scenario by which a firearm could get into the hands of someone who is not a purchaser, and should the seller be liable for those circumstances? I'm just saying that the remedy here is pretty narrow in that it only arises from the purchaser rather than, say, someone who is taking a gun out of a store and because it was not properly secured. That would not be a purchaser, obviously. That might not have liability in that situation, and that may have also have a constitutional issue in that you're eliminating a remedy for a specific class of people. And I'm just throwing this out for clarification because our goal at the subcommittee level here is to work these problems out so by the time we get to the full committee, you get a work session and get out of here. And maybe we have to look at that one. And maybe look at the case of Senator, that Representative McPherson cited, because it seems it might be a little bit more, a little closer to my hypothetical that I'm raising this morning. Okay, further discussion.
Well,
Senator.
Mr. Chair, by my reading of the bill as in its current form, I think it does not, I don't see anything that would not cause the protections in Section 1 to extend to acts of negligence, other than, as you point out, where there's a legal sale, but where the seller knew or should have known about the purchaser's misuse of the firearm. In the case of the fact pattern involved in the Kimbler case, I don't see anything in the bill that would not extend the protection of this of a liability to that retailer who was negligent in the way they stored and displayed the weapon, and making it possible for somebody, a lawbreaker, to come in and take the weapon away.
Okay, further discussion.
Just as long as we're going down memory lane here, I thought I'd tell you about the first time I killed a deer. I was 16 and I did it with the bumper of my GM truck, and the deer's family sued GM. So I just thought I'd share that with the committee as long as everyone has these boyhood experiences.
Was it at night?
Yeah. I was illegally poaching officer. And
there you go. Spotlight is deer.
Okay, for the questions of this panel, we have a few more signed up to testify. Thank you very much for your participation. Next group, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator for District 9. I'm here to comment on House Bill 2373. Appreciate Representative Burley and Senator Wesson bringing this bill forward. I am the co-sponsor of an identical bill that is currently in the Senate. I was touched by Senator Morris's stories, and I'm sure many of us could have tell similar stories, and I know I could. In fact, today I have young children, and I'm trying to pass on the love of firearms and shooting sports to those children, and I know that my kids and I like to go out, and they're especially fond now of shooting clay pigeons, and it's a great afternoon experience to go out and spend some time with the kids doing that. I'd like to focus today, this bill and the Senate bill that's identical to it, on the issue of economic development. This bill, let me back up. My focus in the interim and my focus this session is basically on two things. One is on the meth problem we have, and I know that your committee, not specifically this sub, but the other sub, will be dealing with meth issues just like the Judiciary Committee and the Senate is. The other focus I have this session is on economic development, and specifically economic development for rural Oregon. What happened in the 1990s when the most of Oregon was booming, or not most of Oregon, maybe population-wise, but the focus of economic development in the 1990s was in the I-5 corridor, a little bit up the 84 corridor too, but predominantly the I-5 corridor. And my district where, you know, most of my district is about 10 miles east of I-5, and economic development never got that far off of the I-5 corridor. What this bill has the potential to do is to help to keep a small industry we have today in rural Oregon, and hopefully we'll make it so others will come here. You've already heard about Nosler. You've heard about Leopold. Those are great companies. We appreciate having them in the state. But I'd like to speak of other small companies. Kimber has been mentioned. That used to be a fairly major manufacturing company of firearms. In recent years, they, because of economic issues and other issues inside the company, they have declined some, but they're up in Clackamas. But they are still a manufacturer of firearms we have in the state. With me is Mr. York. He is currently a manufacturer of firearms, a small one, two-man shop out in my district. We have many of these throughout the state, throughout rural Oregon, gunsmiths, private people who custom manufacture firearms. And these people, most of them are single proprietors. They work in their shop or their garage. They build guns one at a time, high-end guns. And these people are in fear every day of if they can get insurance, liability product insurance, whether, you know, will that protect them if their product is used in a crime. So this bill, I see, it's an economic development bill. It's going to help keep an industry we have and hopefully make it grow. I had another small firearm manufacturing company in my district a couple of years ago. They had 3 employees. Unfortunately, they're not there today. I don't know if it's because of the insurance costs, but I do know that the company is gone, and those people who they used to have a job in their community and build a product, exported the product. Most of their product was exported into Europe. They're not there. Those 3 individuals are now traveling to outside the district. One of them actually works for Leopold now, so he's traveling from Molalla to Beaverton every day. What we have in many rural towns, what we see is the people have to leave the town to work. That increases congestion on our roads, increases the likelihood of juvenile delinquency because the parents aren't home and the children aren't in school. All kinds of social problems are created by the fact that most of our society from rural Oregon is going to an urban area to work. Bills like this will help get jobs, get small manufacturing facilities like Senator Morris's in Sweet Home. Appreciate that very much. That facility is in my district. I appreciate Senator Morris putting that facility in Sweet Home because Sweet Home is a very depressed area. Unemployment way up in the middle teens. I think it's about 14% now unemployment in the Sweet Home area. We need small manufacturing facilities like that in our small towns, and this bill will help keep them there and hopefully attract more. I'd like to introduce Mr. York and let him put a personal face to the story with what this bill will do, and I appreciate any questions you may have for me after.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good, proceed.
My name is Wayne York, and as Roger said, I'm a custom gun manufacturer, but I'm also a retired state trooper from this state. Served 21 years with the Oregon State Police. During that time, I shot competitively internationally and in police combat. I'm a 3-time national record holder in police combat. And I say that only to point out that I am and have been active in shooting sports most of my life, and it's been a big part of my life. And really, the point I wanted to make, or just the information that I wanted to make sure that all of you have, is that it was brought up earlier today about some of the bigger companies, Nosler, Leupold, Stevens. You've all heard this, and I'm not aware, or I'm not sure that you all are aware, that there are a number of custom gun manufacturers in this state, one or two or three or four man operations. And yes, myself, I involve myself in a couple of apprentices, and my wife, of course. I do not have a retail store where people walk in and look at stuff on the shelves. I build custom hunting rifles. And if you want to come to the Rocky Mountain Elk show next week, you can see my booth. But this bill obviously could have a great effect on a number of people in Oregon. Actually, it's a pretty large number. I spoke with two or three of my fellow gun manufacturers before I came down here, and I can tell you that they all have a very similar interest in this bill. And we all have a concern over the issue of civil litigation. I can't afford insurance. If I was to pay an insurance premium for what I do, I wouldn't make any money. And that's something that we're faced with. We just kind of live at risk, I guess. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for the panel from the committee?
Thank you,
Senator.
Mr. Chair. May I also speak a little bit to the questions that Representative McPherson had, specifically on Section 2 sub B. I'm not aware of any laws of the state that prohibit or regulate how guns are to be displayed and whether or not they're to be displayed with or without ammunition present. So I believe that number 2B would prohibit a liability case against a store, I think you said, that displayed, that someone came in, broke into the store, stole both guns and ammunition, even if they were stored beside each other. There are people here who are probably more expert in that area than I am, but I am not aware of any laws that prohibit or regulate how guns can be displayed for sale. So I think that probably answers your question.
Right. Yeah, I see, read it the same way. Yeah.
Fine. Thank you. Thank you for that observation. Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2373? Gentlemen, please come forward and state your names for us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder. I'm the Oregon consultant for the National Rifle Association. I have over 60,000 members in the state of Oregon and hundreds in each of your districts. Here today to give our unqualified support for House Bill 2373. And perhaps we should have put this out a little earlier because this is a background as to why this bill was brought forward. In the 108th Congress, similar legislation, NRA sponsored House Resolution 1036 and Senate Bill 659, passed in the U.S. House of Representatives on an overwhelming bipartisan vote of 285-140. Enjoyed more than 54 Senate co-sponsors and had the full support of President Bush. Sadly, efforts to pass this common sense reform were derailed in the United States Senate when a number of anti-gun amendments were attached to it. This legislation is brought to you today because of the failure of Congress to protect those legal firearms entities that employ Oregonians and contribute to our state's economy. To date, 33 states have enacted laws to prohibit localities and others from filing these abusive suits that are designed to bankrupt a lawful, well-regulated industry. As long as gun ban organizations, big city mayors, and greedy trial lawyers are allowed to blame the firearm industry for the criminal misuse of its products, the entire industry is at risk of being destroyed. It is critical that Oregon pass this legislation to ensure that none of these predatory lawsuits seek to circumvent the legislative process and bankrupt a lawful and legitimate industry take place here. This bill will not prohibit lawsuits against the firearm industry for legitimate reasons, such as the manufacturer of a truly defective firearm. It will not protect a licensed dealer who breaks the law. The only suits that would be blocked by this proposal are those that seek to hold the lawful gun industry liable for the unforeseen criminal acts of third parties. Closing, I encourage you to support this legislation to protect our state firearms industry. I thank you for your consideration. We'd be pleased to answer any questions that you might have. I would like to address Representative Girard's question as regards to should have known. in any sale through any legitimate outlet, those folks are subject, purchasers are subject to a background check. And if that background check is properly done, properly executed, the firearm transferred properly, I think that relieves the liability of the seller if he has complied with the law. There are, for Representative McPherson's comments, I think there is some credible stance there. However, there are a couple sections of the law with regards to reckless endangerment, perhaps, that that could come into play. There's nothing in the bill that speaks to reckless endangerment, but there is a provision in ORS about recklessly endangering others, and I that could take up the appeal decision that you spoke to earlier. I am not an attorney, but I do think that it does, it will require some exploration before we go forward with the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll take the testimony of the other two witnesses before we open up for the questions. So whomever wishes to proceed, let me know.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation, and we're here to support the bill. It's unfortunate that we live in a time where political agendas intersect with greed, but that is what makes this bill necessary, and when we do support it. I just wanted to address Representative McPherson. I think you'll find that as for the regulations involving display of firearms, although I'm pretty confident there's nothing in Oregon law about that, federally firearms licensed dealers are heavily regulated by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms rules, and I believe their regulations very specifically address how guns are to be stored when the shop is closed and it's not business hours.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jared Broadfoot, here today representing Oregon gun owners to show our support for House Bill 2373. This bill makes sense. It's sad that we have to come forward with something like this, but across the nation, these frivolous lawsuits against law-abiding manufacturers have sprung up all over the place. It does seem silly that we need to push something like this through, but in speaking with manufacturers of firearms and ammunition throughout this state and other states, it's something that they need very much. It will protect them from making their lawful product, and we don't see any reason that they should be punished for that. Now, some of these businesses, whether it be a small one, a couple guns every other month, or whether it's a large bullet manufacturer, a civil lawsuit against them would cripple their ability to operate and could potentially put them out of business. And you've heard all of this before, but we can't stress enough how much we need this legislation. And we urge your support. I'd be happy to answer any questions or provide any background information.
Fine. Thank you for your testimony. Questions of the panel by the committee?
Is that a question, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You all know that this bill, like every other proposal dealing with firearms, typically initiates or instigates a knee-jerk reaction from legislators as we position ourselves and split right down gun, anti-gun legislation. And I appreciate the appeal that you're making to me is one that would typically be on the anti-gun. To look at this piece of legislation is not typically a firearms one, but to look at the substance of the bill and in terms of the different aspects of the law. So I'm wondering if you, in that spirit, I want to believe that this... this is not going to split down the gun, anti-gun laws. I don't know, I mean, bills, but I can't think of any other bill out there reforming firearms, which would be typically on the side of the anti-gun folks, that you guys would ever consider in terms of not a gun, anti-gun bill and look at the substance of the proposal. So is there any kind of anti-gun legislation or proposals out there that you all would consider in terms of appealing to your sense of looking at the substance of the law, the proposal, as opposed to just the nature of
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, here we are again. I can't answer that question. I don't know. I can't put that in context, but I don't view this as a gun bill. Gun legislation this year is not especially popular, and this bill came forward strictly as a civil liability bill. I don't see. I think what we're the firearms industry has been under attack nationwide, and to me, this when these suits are brought forward, it's kind of like suing the maker of a scalpel if a surgeon kills the patient. And as far as your question goes, I can't answer that question, but I don't look at this. I don't view this as a firearms bill. I view this as a civil liability bill.
If I'm, Mike, I think I can give you a briefer answer, Chair Ackerman, Representative Worth. The answer would be no.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions of the committee to the panel? Hearing none, we again thank you for your testimony here this morning. And I will conclude the public hearing on House Bill 2373. Any other business before the committee? Hearing none, we're adjourned.